Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
2024 is an election year on both sides of the Atlantic. With polarizing politics, disinformation and disillusionment with politicians at possibly their highest levels since the end of the Second World War, it has never been more important to understand what our politics can and should be. With that in mind, the Napoleonic Wars pod is taking a look back at the people and politics of the Napoleonic era, putting policies and politicians under the spotlight, helping us to appreciate the long origins of our political systems and consider what qualities of leadership we might want our politicians to demonstrate. At no point will the show try to influence which way you vote later this year, but I will always be adamant of one thing. No matter what, vote. Exercise your right to make your voice heard, because the decision you make may not just have implications for the next political term, but could echo for a generation. Links to information on how to register to vote are in the episode description. Tonight, we open with America's first president, George Washington, in what will likely be the first of two episodes. In this one, we take a look at the wider life of the man, considering his military career and personal life in more depth. An episode dedicated to his politics and presidency will follow later. We talk about his political convictions and his controversies, his successes and his failings, and his impact on the fledgling United States. This is George Washington, officer and founding father, up next on the Napoleonic Wars pod.
Hello and welcome back to the Napoleonic Wars podcast. I've got Eddie Zimmerman back with me, the ever excitable Eddie Zimmerman, the lead historian at Washington's Crossing and PhD researcher specializing actually on Burgoyne's campaign during the AWI. The reason Eddie is particularly excitable today, though, is that we are doing the guy that he affectionately refers to as G-Dubs. I am anticipating a serious amount of fanboying incoming over the course of the next, to be honest, it's probably going to be more than an hour. It's probably going to be like 2 hours, knowing Eddie and the level of his knowledge and the ability to just go off on one when it comes to this topic. He's nodding kind of sheepishly at me because he knows I've got a point and there's nothing he can do about it. Eddie, great to see you, my friends. We're going to be talking Washington today. How are you feeling about it?
Man, it's a pretty big topic. So he's a pretty big person to talk about and big shoes to fill. So I hope I can only do it justice.
Oh, can I do it justice? He says, of course he'll do it justice. I've never known a guy be able to go on about the American War of Independence to the level of depth that this guy does. And I say that with much love in my heart. So let's talk pre-Washington, actually, and just talk about ancestry and sort of, I guess, early life as well. Where does Washington, inverted commas, come from, both in terms of his ancestors and the migration to the 13 colonies as they were pre-revolution? And what's he doing, you know, in the early stages of his life? He's not a poor guy by any stretch of the imagination. You know, he's not somebody who crawls out of the gutter, is he?
Well, I guess it depends on what you consider poor by the standards and social status. But the Washington family, right, the greater family, they're from a place called Solgrave in Northamptonshire, England. And in their case, they fell on the wrong side of your Civil War, and ultimately find their way over to the Virginia colony. And the family is going to essentially settle along the Potomac River, which is the dividing line between Virginia and Maryland. And for those who are unfamiliar, it's the river that divides Washington, D.C. from Virginia and Alexandria and all that. So Washington, the family, and later on young George, is going to grow up in what we now call Northern Virginia, or Nova, right, for the more local people. But he's born in 1732, and he's the oldest child of a second marriage from his father. So, and often George will refer to his brother Lawrence Washington, who is essentially kind of like the figure he looks up to as a young man. But Lawrence, who does have a commission in the British Army through the provincial element of it. But, you know, so that's kind of who he attaches to. So George, for what it's worth, isn't really entitled to too much of inheritance or status within society. So he's almost, to me, how I've always kind of viewed him is kind of like a middle class standing with no particular boost to jettison to him what he becomes later on in his life. So in other words, he's almost kind of like there's nothing that in his early life that denotes that he's going to become the father of a country one day, right? I mean, you know, for what it's worth, that, you know, certainly not poor. His father is a public figure. He's a justice of the peace. And, you know, they do own some land, and which is the kind of the status quo in Virginia society. It's an agricultural society, a plantation society, and wealth is certainly measured in part by the amount of land that you own. So, you know, George, for what it's worth, he doesn't have a college education. He's one of the few founding fathers who doesn't. He essentially teaches himself to a degree to read and write, and a lot of his customs and the man that he becomes later on is self-driven, and it's self-taught, and it's something he's very conscious of, especially when you get to later on in Congress and his role in founding the country. He's always very sensitive to that subject. So but from an early age, you know, and he's such a hard person to talk about, because he's, you know, he's everywhere in our culture. I mean, he's the father of our country. He's the highest ranking officer ever. And in 1976, they confirmed that. You know, so 200 years after the point, you know, but it's, you know, he's on our dollar bill. He's on Mount Rushmore. I mean, the capital of our country is named after him. He's got the tallest monument to any individual in the country. And you have a state named after him all the way out 3,000 miles away to a place he's never even probably never knew existed, to be honest with you. But, you know, he's just got that status, and he's, you know, there's probably more myth and legend behind him than, you know, the reality of it. But I mean, you know, certainly, you know, there's stories or, you know, mythology, I guess, that, you know, we kind of are told and think about, like, you know, chopping the cherry tree down and you can never tell a lie and all that. And whether or not that's true or not, I mean, you know, the point is it gives you an insight to the character of the man. And the one thing about Washington that I think, you know, if nothing else is clear through this whole discussion, on the one thing about Washington that makes him who he is, you know, not only to his contemporaries, but to Americans today, is it's his personality. It's his mannerisms. It's his presence. And I think we'll kind of get through that as we go through. But as a young man, you know, again, he's not necessarily entitled to some of the things, the first sons, or, you know, that kind of a system that you know, was so prevalent in the world at the time. He, in effect, has to make his own way. So one of the biggest ambitions or driving forces for the young Washington was military service. And he saw his way. So before we get into that, and there's so many like Americanisms about him. That's what I like to call them, like these Americanisms that, like, I feel like all Americans have in our soul, right? And a lot of, and not that George Washington's the first to do it, or the, you know, but he's the symbol of it, right? In a lot of ways. And what he shows is that, you know, you can be from a certain standard or a certain class or a certain background, but you can, through hard work, dedication, ambition, and drive, achieve something that, you know, in an old world society, you would never been allowed to have. And I think he sets that, now he's of course not the only one who does it, but I mean, he's, you know, the tip of the spear, right, in terms of memory. So for him, this drive to be top of society in Virginia society, for him, is going to come through military service. And that's where he sees himself. That's his greatest ambition, you want to call it. And that's certainly his driving force as a young man. So what does he do to get into that? Well, you know, as a provincial, as an American, as someone not from Great Britain necessarily, it's very hard to achieve a commission in the British Army. It's probably just as hard for people from Britain to get commissions to a degree, right? So, yeah.
All about the money. It's always about the money. Buy your way in.
Then, Washington's actually, he's almost like a Richard Sharp in a sense, in terms of someone that should have never got it, but, you know, how can you not give it to them? You know, so if you kind of look at it through that lens a little bit, I think Washington's better off than you know, Mr. Sharp, but, you know, kind of keep that as the framework. But he makes his fortune, or he makes his real name in land surveying, which is huge profitable industry in the colonies at the time. And George becomes very good at it. And one of the things he gets to do, which more important to the larger story, is he gets a feel of what it's like, I guess, to campaign, quote unquote. I mean, it's not like these guys are staying in, you know, hotels or anything. I mean, they're in the backwoods in Pennsylvania, Virginia, Maryland, you know, modern day West Virginia, the Ohio country, really. I mean, what we call the Ohio country back then. So it's rough. And he's dealing with, you know, Native American tribes, and he's dealing with French, and he's dealing with rough settlers, but more importantly, he's getting an eye for terrain, which is going to be extremely valuable to him later in life. And he's getting a sense of discipline and how to manage, you know, manage land and manage, you know, how you use the land. And, you know, and that eventually brings him into joining the local militia. And that eventually fast forwards him, and I'm jumping over a lot here, but, you know, that lands him a provincial rank. I don't know if he was initially a major or lieutenant colonel. I read both, so someone that knows, you know, but don't crucify me over that. But, you know, he's an officer, and he gets sent by Governor Dinwiddie of Virginia on behalf of the British, right, to go out to the Ohio country, to the what we call the Forks of the Ohio, which is modern day Pittsburgh, right? That region. And then and there's, you know, for those who aren't familiar with Pittsburgh, it's a series of three rivers that come together in the Ohio country. And it was highly, at least in the 1750s, it was highly, highly sought after by both the British and the French, not to mention the Native Americans who lived there, didn't want either side coming in. So there's this trifecta of this river system, this geographical feature is extremely important. And whoever holds it is going to be economically successful in the long run. So,
yeah, I mean, we'll get to the Seven Years' War in just a second. Funny that you say, you know, Major Lieutenant Colonel, this explains why I've seen both. And both when I was doing this at secondary school, but also, you know, in trying to prep for this series so that I can vaguely keep up with you, or at least not ask totally dumb questions.
Before we get to Seven Years' War, though, I just want to tap a bit deeper into the sort of the
Sure.
personality thing that you were talking about there. What's he like as a person? Because this is going to dominate a lot of what follows, right? You know, his nature
Yeah.
as a human being. So what's he like?
Well, I mean, so that, and that's another difficult topic. I mean, I think everyone agrees that he's along the same caliber, but again, it depends on who you read and how you interpret, the history as always. But to me, he's always been a deeply ambitious man. And I don't mean that in a way that, he's not ambitious like Napoleon, right? Or somebody like that. He's ambitious for the sense that he wants to make, a life for himself and a notable life and be a notable person in society. And I don't think that is something that's negative. It's just something that, that's he wants to leave the world in a better place than he came in it. He's very quiet. He's very, very quiet in terms of how he conducts himself. He's very cautious in how he speaks. And he's very cognizant of the fact that, his presence as a person goes a long way. And that's something that you're going to see consistently throughout as we talk about him. And it's just one of those things that makes him so great. So, just to give you maybe a concept of it, I mean, one of the things that he does as a young man is he like memorizes and internalizes like, readings like the rules of civility and how to conduct yourself and how to walk into a room. And when you walk into a room, where do you go into that room? He's very, very conscious of his public appearance and how he appeared to others. I have read and, any study of him, of at least during the war, will show you, he had an incredible temper, that he consistently had to work at to keep under wraps. He does a very good job of it. Considering, all the drama and all the things that are going to happen to him later on. But he's got a humble nature about him. And I say that not, I mean, how can you be humble and lead an army and be the first, but he has this, he's approachable, right? He's approachable. He's not, he never, I mean, okay. I mean, he's from the society he's from the world that he's from. And there is a social standing within the colonies. There's certainly all of that, but he's not so elusive that he's human, right? And he's able to show that, and people follow him for that, right? So he's to that, and in another sense too, he's also got I don't want to say necessarily grudges, but he's been denied a lot in life and things that he sought out after, and so he's got this drive to not only make his situation better, but those around him. He's also got a final ability that I've always admired about him, and that's to trust other people. Again, we talk about the precedences that he sets, and there's so many things that he sets in precedences, and that we just don't even realize because we're just so used to it, in society. But the cabinet, right? Like he's really the founder of like the presidential cabinet, right? I mean, and that's something that we've kept in our system ever since. I mean, but he starts that with his military family, which we'll get into. But so he's never afraid to ask. He's never afraid to second guess himself or ask opinions. But he's always a man that's in control of himself and his actions and those around him. And he, some of that he learns the hard way, which we'll come to find out here very soon. And some of that is natural to him. But in that sense, and then as a final thought, he's an imposing man. I mean, he's 6'2", 6'3". Right, he's an excellent horseman. He's an outdoorsman. I mean, he's hunting, fishing. I mean, he has that American mystique to him of, he's refined, but he's hard-nosed and he's got a rough edge about him from living outdoors and being an outdoorsman. So, something I think a lot of Americans identify with.
So that's the positive element. That there's obviously going to be the controversy element that is going to be the elephant in the room if we don't start talking about it, right? And that is, of course, that Washington inherited slaves. He also purchased slaves. And at the point at which he died, I looked it up, and I think it was 120 odd individuals that he personally owned at the time that his will was read. So this guy's a slave owner. Yes, he's a founding father. All men are equal,
And yet, you know, you have this fundamental problem that applies not exclusively to Washington. Let's acknowledge that. This is a thing that is, you know, symptomatic of British society as much as it is of American society during this period. It applies to other founding fathers, but it does create this kind of this problem, right? That you've got somebody who, for very obvious reasons that you've outlined, you know, has a number of virtues that Americans to this day respect. He has this vast historical legacy. You know, America is partially built upon his back. And yet you've also got this other problem to reconcile all of that with. So talk us through that and how is America kind of negotiating that, I guess, right now?
It's a loaded question, but I'll do my best. So, I mean, yeah, Washington, like, you know, and I don't always like to necessarily point to that this is a Virginia thing or Southern thing. I mean, slavery exists in all 13 colonies to varying degrees. So it's more concentrated in other areas. It's, you know, it takes a different process legally in the states and the colonies and things like that. But Washington is a man of his era. I mean, that's just, you know, and he certainly plays within the bounds of what was accepted in society at the time. And certainly, I mean, listen, Washington made his fortune, right, off the backs of enslaved people. I mean, that's just, you know, and certainly Mount Vernon, you know, which he inherits from Lawrence, right? Actually, he inherits it from Lawrence's widow when she dies in, I think, 1760 or 1761, something like that. But I mean, so, you know, he inherits, you know, the slaves and, you know, and runs a tobacco operation. You know, and with slavery, I mean, I guess to whatever level, you know, you take it. I mean, obviously it's a cruel institution, and I don't think anyone can question that. But I think when you look at how he operated within that system, you know, and you break down the level, the tier levels of that institution, I think Washington, I mean, he's never struck me as a cruel individual. He's never struck me as someone that would, you know, would apply, you know, for him, it was a profitable thing. For him, it was a plan, you know, and he certainly for, you know, as shown in his deathbed and his will, you know, to free the people that he had enslaved. I think one of the greatest stories, if to kind of look at, is Billy Lee or William Lee, which was Washington's personal servant. And depending on how you want to read it, or depending on what, you know, how you want to prescribe it, I mean, they had a friendship. There was a bond between them. And there's a saying, and, you know, certainly, you know, Washington was considered the greatest horseman in America at the time. And if Washington's number one, Billy Lee was number two, because, or 1A, or, you know, because he was always with him and next to him. There's instances during the war where Billy Lee, you know, is going to try to put himself in front of Washington to save him, and them two almost kind of getting into it, you know. So it's a very complex issue. And I think Washington's views on it are not necessarily how we would interpret it in modern times, but I think it's a system that was in place. It's a system that was accepted in society, and it's a system that he played to his advantage. And the prophets of Mount Vernon show that, you know. But and then another way, you know, if you get into his presidency later on, I mean, and he's criticized for this, and it's a very delicate, it's a hard issue, right? And it's easy to sit back in 2023 and say, well, you know, I would have done this and I would have done that. But the way I like to look at it is, men like Washington, and you said it too, I mean, Washington isn't, I mean, you have Jefferson asked the same question, and you know, Adams, and all, you know, not that Adams didn't have slaves, but, you know, some of these founding fathers it did and some of them it didn't. And there's this question of, like, we know this collectively is not right. But, like, if we end this institution, and this is going to sound harsh, but if we end this institution now, just, which is the morally right thing to do, but if we do this now, then we risk of destroying this union of colonies, when we risk of destroying everything that we just fought for or going to fight for. And we opened up the opportunity for Spain or France or England or whoever else to come back. And chances are, you know, that system, you know, and is not going to be displaced. It's just going to be intensified. So maybe, maybe not. That's a great what if. But my point of bringing that up is when you look at the policies later in their life, in the 1780s and 1790s, there's this, on one hand, Washington is firm on the idea of keeping the institutions tight, but on the other hand, he's attempting to limit it. And it's if you look at it like building a house, if you look at it, you know, in that sense, like they're laying the foundation and the framework, right, for what's going to come later in the 1860s. The Civil War is a horrible thing, and a lot of things happen, but ultimately, right, the institution of slavery is eliminated. And then, of course, that brings you into a new era of struggle of civil rights and everything else, right? So, but the way I like to look at it is Washington, Jefferson, or any of these guys could have made the absolute conscious decision to say, we're not touching that. It's just going to stay the way it is. Forget about these people. Forget about this institution. And, you know, it's all about us, right? And I know there's certainly arguments out there that suggest that. And I don't necessarily discount them. I think everything's multilayered. But there's also this, we know this is wrong. We know that this can't continue forever. But we need to do this in a way that doesn't rip everything apart within this country. And I know that might not sound pleasing to a lot of people, but that's just the way, you know, you have to do it, at least, you know, from his perspective. So for that, I give him credit, but it doesn't discount his involvement in it, right? If that makes sense.
It totally does. And, you know, there are a couple of things that I would just kind of add to that. Firstly, you know, as I emphasized when I asked the question, where do the colonists get this concept from? Well, they get it from us, from Britain. What does it take to end that? Well, you know, Britain doesn't abolish the slave trade until 1807. And then exactly these kinds of arguments are put forward and go backwards and forwards in Parliament, where people are going, well, is it practical to end slavery as an institution right here and now? And that's a thing that it takes Britain, you know, sort of 25 odd years to get to grips with. It's not until 1833, I believe, that slavery itself is abolished. And then in a situation not dissimilar to the US, you know, there's this whole kind of legacy of rights for these individuals, not in quite the same way, but discrimination remains rife to this day. And equally, look at what happens to eliminate slavery in the US. You know, you have to have a civil war to get there. And that pragmatism argument kind of comes again to that. It kind of adds that credence, the pragmatism argument, doesn't it? That actually, was America ready for this? Well, frankly, it didn't look like half of America was ready for this in the 1860s, almost a century after formation. Now, that doesn't mean that its continuation is okay, but it does at least explain why it wasn't ended in the 1770s, 1780s, as, you know, we might have hoped looking back on it 250 years later. I want to talk about family as well before we start talking about career and military record and all the rest of it. What's he like as a family man?
So, you know, George, again, he's interesting in the sense where, like, he comes from this background where it's like he inherits Mount Vernon, right? Like, you know, and in the same way, his, you know, Martha Washington, right? You know, she's already a widow, you know, she's already married. So, and she's wealthy and she has a lot, you know, so there's certainly, you know, maybe there's a financial gain in it, right? But he's a good gentleman. I mean, he's a gentleman. He, you know, raises her children like his own. He never has his own children. You know, we can speculate to why, and that's not something I really probably want to dive too deep into in that respect. But, you know, point is, he doesn't have his own children, which I think is also a benefit to us today, because, I mean, imagine having someone, you know, well, I'm George Washington's great, you know, or whatever. I mean, that can lead to some, you know, drama and everything. But so he leaves us, you know, and I think that's a gift in a sense to us. And that adds to his mystique. But no, I mean, from all accounts, he's a complete gentleman. I mean, he, you know, and Martha will come with him throughout the war and campaign, and he constantly writes her and things like that. But, you know, he's the, you know, I guess in my opinion, or in a lot of ways, he's the model gentleman of the era, right? Based off the standards of the era. And And, you know, you never really hear anything negative in that respect about him. So I don't know how in-depthly he was involved with his stepchildren, to what degree, but I mean, like I said, I've never personally have never come across anything saying either way, or at least negative. But, you know, again, that consistent being of a gentleman, to of quiet, of, you know, very focused on what he is intending to do with, you know, the arena around him. So if I know that's a broad stroke to a specific question, but that's the best I can give you off the cuff.
That's absolutely fine. Let's talk about the Seven Years' War, though, sure, which is where I diverted us from a while back. My sense when I was originally learning about this, which admittedly was sort of nearly a decade and a half ago, was I sort of read the details and went, well, that's not very impressive, is it? His story of the Seven Years' War. There's this thing about a fort, and then he builds this fort, and then it all goes wrong, and basically ends up with a whole load of egg on his face. And you sort of look at it and go, well, why is everybody so obsessed with this guy? What's the big deal? Because it's not a story of success. Is that fair?
It's not at all. So, you know, I mean, George Washington started a world war. I mean, not intentionally, anything like that. But I mean, it, you know, the Jumonville Glen massacre, right, as what the French call it, you know, it certainly it triggered a world war. Now, I think it was a war that was coming, right? I mean, certainly, you know, Britain and France had it coming, you know, but that's the it, that's the spark, right, and to a degree. So, and you have to remember, I mean, he's only 20, 21 years old, maybe 22. I mean, he's a young man with no military experience, you know. On top of that, I mean, if you get into the militia system of the colonies, I mean, it's not exactly, you know, the British Army or the Prussian Army or anything like that. I mean, it's it's the militia system, right? I mean, it's got a lot of flaws in it, and it varies, and so he's involved in that, right? But you know, the sensitive subject of the Ohio country, of the Forks. I mean, that is a major economical thing, and you know, and certainly Virginia wants to claim it, you know, Britain wants to utilize it, France obviously wants it, the Delaware or Lenape Indians, you know, like that's their new homeland, and you know, and it's like, well, we're not giving it up. So there's a lot of different, you know, aspects to it. But you know, he goes out, he delivers this letter, you know, he gets laughed at basically, and he comes back, and he's given command of a Virginia regiment. They go out there, and they link up with Lenape, Delaware. Lenape is the actual name. Delaware is what everyone in the world knows them as, but a Delaware chief called the Half King. And you know, the Half King, and this is kind of important to why what happens with George basically. Kind of, I don't want to say false victim necessarily, but he's used as a pawn. His rank is used as a pawn for, you know, the Delaware or the Lenape agenda, which was, for those who aren't really too familiar with Native culture, everything's run in with elders in the tribe. Typically, women are usually the elders and make the decisions from the tribe, which is very fascinating. But the Half King, and that gives you an idea of his title. He's a Half King, so he's got, you know, he doesn't have full powers as some of the under Native chiefs and things like that. But he says, listen, we should ally with the British, because that's going to benefit us the most over the French, whereas the rest of the tribe or the council felt that the French were the way to go, and probably rightly so, because the French had a very they weren't as intrusive as the English colonists or things like that. So he gets denied that. Well, he actually gets they accept it, but then the French come in and start building a fort, right? And that makes him look really bad to within his council and tribe. So he's got this mindset that he's going to create a conflict between the English and the French so that the Delaware peoples can maintain their holdings in the region. And it's a pretty smart idea. I mean, it's politically savvy. It's, you know, diplomatically savvy, you know, for the Indians. But what ends up happening is Washington, they come across a French party under this officer named Jumonville. And to make a long story short, the inexperience of Washington and the massive experience of the Half King and et cetera ends up being an ambush, and they end up massacring the French, and the natives end up, you know, scalping them. And it's traumatizing to George Washington, and it's traumatizing to some of his Virginians. And it's a political disaster. Of course, where it gets back, you know, Washington being the ranking officer is responsible for that, right? And that's in the customs of the ancient regime, right, of the time. So now he's responsible for a murder, right, which is essentially what it is in the European sense of it. And the Half King abandons him, which you can't blame them either, because, you know, they started what he needed to start, and now they're just going to go sit out and hopefully, you know, these French and English, you know, do each other off. We see this inexperience with Washington, you know. Now the rest of the regiment comes and they build Fort Necessity, and which is a, you know, a stockade fort in a low-lying field surrounded by woods. And this to me is his first learning curve, right? Because there's this poor placement of, you know, this is someone without military training, really. I mean, you know, so, you know, what seems like a good idea obviously isn't one, but they build this. And of course there's this, and this is another theme I want to interject, because it's going to continue on throughout his life, but there's this, you know, he's got a commission from Virginia, right? So he's a colonel from Virginia, but there's a captain from South Carolina, right? With a British commission. So even a British captain outranks a Virginia colonel. So there, you know, there's an argument between these two, right? And there's, so to make a long story short, the, you know, the native, the allies of the French, and the French show up, and the French were very good at adapting to native tactics and strategies. And, you know, basically they surround the fort, you know, there's a battle and it doesn't last long. It starts downpouring, the powder gets wet, and Washington surrenders, right? Because he has to. There's no other option. And he resigns. He goes back to Virginia, you know, and then that's in 1754. 1755, a lot of things change. So what Washington has is a lot of inexperience, and, you know, he's the you know, the spark of a world war, and he surrendered his regiment, right? Like, I mean, that's not a good show. But he still holds this respect amongst his peers because of the caliber of the young man that he is. And that's important. That's important. I mean, he owns it. He gracefully reenters Virginia, and, you know, he retains the confidence of the governor and the House of Burgesses and all the other political elements involved. But he, as a volunteer, signs on with, I don't know if he's a sir or not, but General Braddock, Edward Braddock, and you correct me if he's Sir Edward Braddock, I don't know, I apologize. But Edward Braddock comes, and he's supposed to be, we were talking about Schwarzkopf earlier, right? He's like this Schwarzkopf-like figure, right? He's coming, and he's going to, you know, they're going to drive the French and the Delaware people right out of the forks, and, you know, this is it. He brings his army, which is two regiments, the 44th Regiment of Foot and the 48th Regiment of Foot. And they're going to be supplemented by, they say Virginia Militia, but really it's two companies, Virginia Rangers. There's Pioneers. There's some Pennsylvania Frontier Ranger Riflemen S troops. And I think some from South Carolina again, right? So it's this mixed provincial force and regular force. And what he's going to see in Braddock is really his first taste of military life, right? Because remember, he's only known this militia system, which is the militia system, right? So what he sees in Braddock is this discipline, is this, you know, extreme, you know, this is right up your alley. You know, Braddock's big on discipline and court martials and order and you know, he sees soldiers whipped for the first time and all these things. And, you know, of course, there's this big, you know, he's sitting back, and of course, Braddock would go on about, well, look how disciplined, you know, the regulars are. And, you know, he had like a distaste somewhat. It's more of a myth, but I mean, there's certainly, like, you know, the American militia, Virginia, you know, they're kind of like, you look at them and they're not necessarily pretty soldiers or disciplined. So, but what happens is they get into the wilderness, they cut this road through the wilderness. For those who are familiar with the region, part of the modern day Pennsylvania Turnpike is built upon the actual road that Braddock's army cut through the wilderness in the backcountry. You know, at Fort Cumberland, they built Fort Cumberland. You know, all these things that come out of this. So what happens is they get to a place called the Monongahela, right? And this is going to occur on July 9th, 1755. And for those who aren't familiar, the modern day city, and it's a small city, but it's more like an industrial place out there. But it's called Braddock, Pennsylvania. That's basically where there's a lot of Braddock named things out that way. But that's basically where the battle is going to unfold. And for me, it's always been probably the scariest battle that's ever happened in the North American continent, and probably the most influential battle. I argue the most influential battle, considering the list of names that were there. Now, if I can just deviate real quick, just to give people a little bit of that. Not only is George Washington there, but so is Thomas Gage, right? He's going to be the first commander in chief for the British Army in 75 during the war. You have William Maxwell. For those who study him, you know, they will know that, you know, he comes to prominent, you know, in the Revolution. You have a guy named Edward Hand, who's a British surgeon, later Continental colonel. And commands a brilliant action at the battle, becomes the Battle of Assunpink on January 2nd, 1777. You have a gentleman named Dan Morgan, who has a, you know, very, very solid reputation, and his first cousin, Daniel Boone, right? And they're Teamsters. They're not even, you know, here's Dan Morgan, who's going to become this, you know, infamous hero, and he's a Teamster with his cousin, Daniel Boone, right? And, you know, Charles Lee, who's going to be the second in command of the Continental Army. He's probably the most experienced soldier in the American service. And the list goes on and on. So, you know, this battle was so horrific that it's one of those things I don't think these guys ever forgot. So to make a long story short, they march down this road, and it's flanked in the wilderness. And, you know, the natives and the French, you know, they, you know, I don't know if, you know, people have seen the YouTube movies or whatever, but I mean, you know, they ambush them. It's horrible. Braddock's trying to, now to Braddock's defense, he's often given this thing where, you know, he just kind of rolled in there and expected to fight this. You know, he did employ, you know, some American like tactics. He did understand that to a degree, but they tried to fight this war in a symmetrical fashion, right? Against an asymmetrical strategy. And that's something that's going to impact George Washington. And those other list of names, you know, men that I named off. Obviously, the British Army is soundly defeated in the backcountry, and it's Braddock's killed or mortally wounded. But George Washington in that moment rises to the challenge, right? He's, you know, again, 20, 22, something like that. It, you know, he commands a rear guard. He has two horses shot from underneath of him during this engagement, and he has got a number of bullets through his jacket. He's untouched, but he comes out of this complete disaster as a national hero, especially to the, you know, provincials and the Americans. So he's awarded that, you know, due to that, he's awarded command of the Virginia Regiment, and essentially he spends the rest of the war just kind of sitting on the frontier, you know, chomping at the bit. And, you know, without getting into a lot of the detail, I mean, he goes to Philadelphia a couple of times. He goes and sees the various commander in chiefs, and he's like, hey, listen, you really need to make the Virginia Regiment an established regiment. I want to be the, you know, and he never gets that opportunity, and that it's a slight towards him. And he takes that very personal, right? He takes that extremely personal, you know, and essentially the war's over. And then he goes back to, you know, he gets back into civilian life, and you know, and during this time, he's, you know, the whole Mount Vernon operation, and he switches from tobacco to wheat, and you know, and he spends an inordinate amount of time. He's very focused on his life at Mount Vernon, and you know, building that place into you know, into what he wants it to be. But similarly, at the same time, he starts getting involved in Virginia politics, which is, I don't ever really consider him a savvy politician, right? But he's involved, and he backs important people. And in what he's doing is he's networking and he's courting, right? Because he's hoping to still achieve this vision of you know, military greatness.
So which side does he end up falling down on? I mean, it sounds like a really obvious question, but based on what you were saying last time about how divided states were, yeah, even on this question of, independence? Is this just kind of a riot? Is this an uprising? Do actually we want to stay loyalist? Where does he fall on that? And how does he respond to the outbreak of hostilities? Is he kind of on the fence initially and then falls down one side?
Or, no, you know, no, not outset, at all. He's again, it's one of these things, you know, and you've already said it. I mean, I think we talked about it the last episode, but for as many different colonies as there were, and the different ethnic groups and religious groups and this group and that group, I mean, there is a million different reasons why to not like the British, right? Or to want to break away. You know, we talk about the rule of thirds, you know, one third's for it, one third is loyal, one third's like, just leave me alone. So there's a lot of, you know, it's a delicate matter with it. So Washington is not a New Englander. He's not fired up like Samuel Adams is, or, you know, or what's going on in Boston. I mean, he's one of the, you know, he's a very wealthy man by this point in his life. He's built a very good life for himself. And it's been at the, you know, at the behest of being in the British Empire. So for me, the way I always look at him, it's one of these things where it's like, why, if your life is so good, what would propel you to want to potentially throw all that away, label yourself as a traitor, but lead this thing, right? It's one thing to just go against the British government, right? But now you're the face of it. You're the commander in chief. So how does he get there? I think a lot of it has to do with this personal slight toward the British, you know, because he has this vision. He has this goal of, I want it, and he's not allowed to have it. So I think it's a personal slight. And I think, you know, to that degree, in Washington's mind, maybe, right, it's more about achieving what he's here to achieve versus his wealth and his status. And I think in that case, that outweighs that for him. So he gets involved, you know, he gets involved with the Continental Congress, the First Continental Congress and the Second Continental Congress, and he attends a lot of these meetings. Now, one of the things that's really neat about him, when you get through the Founding Fathers, a lot of personalities, right? A lot of loud personalities, you know, certainly. But he's a quiet man in the room for, you know, intents and purposes. And one of the things that he consistently does is he comes to Congress wearing a military uniform, right? It speaks volumes, right, about his intentions. And that's something that's very often quoted about him, right? That's like no secret or anything like that. So, and what he's showing by presenting himself in that military uniform is that I am your man. I have military experience. I am a soldier, you know, and it's a visionary thing. So when it comes down to, and I'm fast forwarding and jumping over a lot in this regard,
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But when it comes down to the decision to pick a commander-in-chief, Washington becomes the obvious choice, right? And it's almost funny because John Hancock, right, thinks it's going to be him, right, to a degree. And he's partly shocked when, you know, John Adams turns to George Washington, right? And of course, Washington stands up and, you know, it's almost like they like to portray it as he was like shocked by it. But I mean, I think he knew, you know, and it's like, well, I don't feel like I'm equal to the task. And I only hope, and he shows this humility, whereas like a lot of other military commanders may not, right? They might not show this humility of you know, I am now the highest ranking, you know, soldier in the country or whatever. So he takes that with, you know, now whether or not he was humble about it in his mind, it's a debate, but publicly he's humble about it, right? And that's going to be a precedent. And I think one of the things that keeps him in power as commander in chief, because he has, he bends to the, not want to say bends to the will of Congress, but he recognizes that Congress is his boss, right? And we see in other eras and other military generals where they can, you know, disregard the civil authority at times. But Washington never does that, right? So, you know, so that's kind of the buildup. He's certainly for going against the British in sense, but I don't necessarily think he's so wrapped up into the taxes and this. I think it's more of like a personal vendetta against them.
It's interesting what you say about that humble, or at least that veneer of being humble when he gets given the appointment, because for listening to what you say, it does kind of sound as if he was absolutely angling for a senior military position there. And this idea, absolutely. Oh, what, me? Am I really up to the task? I've only been coming here in uniform every single day to make precisely this point. You know, the skeptic in me just kind of goes, yeah,
that's, right. Yeah, that's...
But, you know, I wasn't there, so who am I to comment? What's his style like as a commander?
Well, I always like to say jokingly, because I would probably upset some people, but, you know, if I showed you his resume, right? If this was like a modern job and you know, we were hiring, you know, you probably wouldn't hire him, right? Because you would see this consistent failure, right? You know, Jubinville and Fort Necessity. And well, you spent time on the frontier and did nothing. And, you know, like you've lost a lot of battles in the War of Independence. I mean, so he's no Napoleon Bonaparte. He's not, you know, he's no Alexander the Great or whoever. I mean, he's a back, you know, backwater militia commander for all intents and purposes. And now he's got command of a Continental Army, which isn't really even really an army, right? So his strategy, you know, to the more colorful historian or you know, enthusiast of, you know, military studies would look at it and be like, this is so simple, right? I mean, there's no pageantry, there's no grand maneuvers or, you know, I don't know, he's no Frederick the Great or anything like that. But what he does is he becomes a total, I don't want to say he goes into it wanting to fight the war on European terms, I think, right, to a degree. And he quickly learns, which we'll get into here shortly, but he quickly learns that he can't, and he has to adopt more of a Fabian strategy. So really, in the biggest picture, he's a Fabian-like commander. And I think that's more by necessity, brought on by the realization of his capabilities and his army's capabilities and the logistics of that. But he's also, you know, he applies an asymmetrical approach to an enemy that is fighting the war in a symmetrical plane with some, you know, irregular approaches themselves. But, and he's able to capitalize that. And he quickly realizes throughout the war that he is the objective, his army. As long as his army remains in the field, then the war keeps continuing. A lot of times what I like to do, and again, this might be an unpopular comparison, but I think it's a one that's very clear, is he's like a Ho Chi Minh, right, in Vietnam. The American army in America, so, you know, and I've said this to you before, and I always maintain it, the American War of Independence was Great Britain's Vietnam in a lot of ways. You know, it's a prolonged conflict. It's in a lot of ways an asymmetrical and guerrilla conflict. And it's one that where you're fighting an empire or a country that has a lot of resources, a lot of military organization and they win the body count, they win the battles, but yet they lose the war. And it's the same thing the Vietnamese did to us in the 1960s and 70s. They kept their troops in the field and they kept them elusive so that we couldn't finish it. So, and that's essentially what Washington does in the larger sense. So, and it's something I feel like you see, you know, in any underdeveloped nation, because I mean, America might be where we're at now, but, you know, 250 years ago or, you know, 46 years ago, we weren't, right? So we were an underdeveloped nation with no system to go to war with, you know, you're pulling out of thin air. So I think these strategies become necessary and they become the only way to fight it. So, and I think he adapts to that. He adapts to that totally and it works out for him. So that's his strategic level as a general. as the man, as a general, he's very, very in tune with listening to his subordinates, to having councils of war, which, you know, great examples. Again, I'll use the S in pink again as a prime example. Why Washington brings his generals in to the Douglas House, right? And says, listen, this is our situation. He already knows what he wants to do, but he wants his generals to come to the same conclusion on their own. So this way there's solidarity in what they're going to do at Princeton the next morning. And they have this candlelight discussion into the night. And then obviously, you know, it's decided they're going to leave and march to Princeton and, you know, whatever. And then, you know, whereas on the opposite side of the Assunpink Creek in Trenton, Cornwallis doesn't do that, right? Lord Cornwallis doesn't do that. He says, well, I'm in command. I have control. And to me, that's a lot of the big differences between, you know, his style of command and some of the British command. But and another note too, I mean, he's very compassionate towards to a degree that you can be as a general. I mean, not, you know, but he's a friend of the soldier, the common soldier. And there's many times throughout the war where Washington pardons a lot of executions and things like that. Not because he's soft and wanting, but because he realizes that in order to get an American to fight, to stay in the service, right? This is not a European army. You know, these Americans are here because they believe in something, and they believe in him, and he has to retain that confidence in them. But, you know, one of the things that you will always come down to when reading anything written by George or His Excellency, right, as we like to call him, is, you know, he's always putting the cause first, right? And I put that in quotations, the cause. And again, the cause of the war and the reason to fight the war will vary as much as every Continental soldier who fought it. But Washington makes sure that his soldiers recognize that they are here for the cause. And that is what is most important. So he combines all these things, right, into a style of leadership that was kind of unprecedented, at least in what was then the modern world. Now, it may have occurred before in other civilizations and things like that. But in terms of you know, what the standard was at the time and you know, European, the manicured manner of European organization, I mean, this is unprecedented, and this is very asymmetrical. And I think that's something that Great Britain was never fully able to come to grips with until it was too late.
So we've talked about the man. Let's talk about the things he's known for, I guess, the successes, but also the failings. What does he do well? And we should say that, you know, we're not going to now do a potted history of the American War of Independence, but just in sort of very general terms, you know, the moments where he shines, but also the moments where, you know, it goes pretty horribly wrong. Because, I mean, this is, you said it yourself just now, you know, there's a lot that the British seem to do that would lead you to think that they're winning the war, and yet in the end, yeah, they lose it. So talk us through it all.
So, I mean, I guess I don't, without diving into and save me if I start going in down these rabbit holes, but, you know, yeah, because you'll have to future episodes, I guess. But, you know, he takes command of this army in Boston, right? And the majority of the soldiers up there are New England troops. And when Washington initially meets them, he can't stand them. And for all my New England friends out there, they are very, they're not the warmest people, right? Good people, but, you know, they're certainly their own breed, right? So, and for a man like Washington to come from the refined Virginia society, right, where there's certainly a old world flair of social status and things like that, to come to New England, where it's very different, was offensive to him. But what he's able to do is he's able to, through his presence, I mean, he gets up to an army that is, he literally has to take the junior officers of this army and show them how to fill out morning reports and just basic stuff. So you're the commander in chief, you're leading an insurrection or an insurgency or a rebellion, whatever you want to call it. You're forming an army you have the British penned up in Boston. They have a Navy. You don't. They have more troops. You know, they have, you know, you got a militia system. And now you're going to try to teach these officers how to, I mean, there's so much on the man's plate. You know, so he, Boston's kind of given to him, right, to a degree. I mean, he gets up there. They already have the British penned in. Lexington and Concord, Bunker Hill, all that's already happened. So he gets there. Now, one of the things that I think that I give him a lot of credit for in that sense is he finds talent in young officers, and he allows them the leeway. And this, again, this is one of those things that's just going to continue up through his leadership. But he's able to find these young officers, and he's able to give them the leeway that they ask for, and he accepts the risk with it. And in this case, there's a 26-year-old Boston bookseller, right, named Henry Knox, whose only experience with military affairs is what he read in the bookstore. Kind of sounds like us a little bit, right? Like, you know, he read all these books, and one of the things that Henry Knox, you know, is he proves himself at Bunker Hill. He designs the entrenchments. He designs a lot of the siege lines, and you know, and he's probably considered the most knowledgeable American on and military engineering with no experience, right, just from the book. So he convinces Washington, hey, we need artillery, right? And we just got Fort Ticonderoga, which is in the middle of the world. It's still in the wilderness, but now it's really in the wilderness then. And it takes him, you know, like a 90-day trip to bring these guns back down through the snow, through ice, and through on sleds and all these things. But whereas everyone else thought that the idea was stupid or it was never going to work, Washington sees that drive in Knox and lets him do it. So, and one of the things that he does by doing that is, you know, you give a person like Knox or Nathaniel Greene or Lafayette, any of these guys that are going to fall under this influence, you give them the opportunity to show themselves, and they do, they become loyal to you, right? And they become loyal to their cause. So Washington has that foresight. Now, obviously we know the guns come, he puts them on Dorchester Heights and William Howe and the British leave, right? So it's this great victory. Oh, well, we drove them out, you know? So everybody premature, oh, we won the war. Well, they're not. You know, Washington says, well, they're going to come back. He's like, they're coming back. There's no question, right? And the question is, where do they come back? And if you look at a map of the 13 colonies at the time, well, okay, there's a couple of places they're going to come, right? Well, they're not coming back to Boston because they're just not. Philadelphia is our largest city at the time. It's the capital. Congress is here. It's a major port city. I mean, you know, that's an idea. But with the American capital being there, you know, chances are most of the residents are Whigs or patriot leaning, right? So where do you go? Well, there's New York, right? For those unfamiliar with New York City, it's really a series of five islands. Manhattan's technically an island, right? So it's this major port, and it's got harbors that you can keep the Great Britain's greatest weapon in the Navy, right? And you have the Hudson River that controls, you know, again, the river systems in America at the time are our major highways, and I'm sure they're probably the same over in Europe, but to control the rivers is to control a region. If you control the regions, you win the war, right? That's the mentality in 76. So, you know, holding New York City is the mouth of the Hudson, which takes you into New York, which separates New England, you know, what they considered then to be the troublesome colonies. And they figured the rest of the Southern or the Mid-Atlantic and Southern colonies would probably just fall back in the line if New England was cut off. So Washington says they're going to definitely come here. Congress agrees. He sends Charles Lee down, right? And Charles Lee gets a lot of flack, and, you know, he's probably one of my most favorite generals to talk about. But for what it's worth, Charles Lee is probably the most preeminent military mind in America. He's a former British officer. I think he's a major general in the Polish army. I mean, he's kind of all over the place, right? And with experience. So he's got more experience than anybody here, that's for damn sure. You know, he goes down, develops defenses. But the point is, you can defend New York all you want, but we don't have a Navy. And Washington, you know, and he makes these moves in Boston to say, you know, he's kind of also the father of the United States Navy to a degree, because he's the first to say, hey, we need a Navy. And he commissions some ships that will eventually, you know, turn into a broader idea. But He knows he's going to have a hard time defending New York. So New York happens. It's an utter failure. The British completely, I mean, you know, handle him and his army. And I'm, you know, obviously going way over, you know, it's like a 10,000 foot view. So for all my Long Island fans, don't crucify me. But, you know, one of the things that George does, or Washington does, in from a strategic level that he does a couple other times, is he leaves his flank open. And, you know, I'm not going to get into the debate of why or why not, but that's essentially what happens. And Henry Clinton convinces Hal and they go through, and, you know, next thing you know, there's this thing. So what happens is it's an absolute disaster. The American army's pressed, they're back against the East River. If you know where the Brooklyn Bridge is today, that's about where this, what's left of this 9,000 men that started the morning are huddled behind these earthworks, and it's over, right? It's essentially over. The war's over, right? For, you know, and it is. But what happens is this miracle happens, right? You know, Washington, and any sane person or any, you know, would say, well, okay, it's over, it's, you know, but he said, well, I'm going to get out of here. And fortunately for him, a fog comes over the East River and they're able to get everybody across the river, right, undetected, right? So then the battles in Manhattan follow suit. There are disasters, Kips Bay. Kips Bay, we see Washington almost ride out to just, he's so despaired, you know, he rides out to just let himself get taken or killed. And, you know, obviously his staff brings him back. But, and you follow that on up through, you know, then, you know, this is, you know, whereas he listened to Henry Knox, he listens to Nathaniel Greene now, but it's, you know, we know it's the wrong decision, you know, with Fort Washington and Fort Lee, and they're absolute disasters. And Fort Lee, I think, still is our greatest defeat in numbers wise in American history. So Washington's army goes from 30,000-ish men to, it's dwindling every day to, you know, by the time we get into New Jersey, what we call the Long Retreat, you know, the army's dramatically dwindling. And of course the retreat's hectic. And, but what you start seeing through that this retreat is there's, you know, and obviously so I wouldn't blame him, but people start questioning his ability, you know, is this the man to really lead? And Washington questions himself, am I really the man to do this? And, you know, Charles Lee and, you know, and Horatio Gates, they get a lot of flack, right? And we have the benefit of hindsight, but can you blame them? I don't think I blame Charles Lee for saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't, you know, because at that point, Washington divides the army and says, look, you know, if one of us gets bagged, at least the other ones are still in the field. And these aren't really armies. They're only a few thousand men in each, right? So, but when he gets his senses about him, he says, I want to concentrate everybody. You know, they start questioning him and pumping the brakes. And that's infuriating to him. And I can understand on both sides, but what he's able to do in a nutshell, I don't want to get too involved in like I said, the nitty gritty, but what he's able to do is he's able to take what's certain defeat, right, by December of 76. And he's able to say through his personality, through his personal leadership and his presence, he's able to keep this army together that is ill-clothed, ill-fed. They haven't been paid in 6 months. Their enlistments are up in a week and it's wintertime. You know, and they're living outside, they burn all their tents and, you know, they have nothing. And he's able, through his example, to keep these men together. And, you know, we know he crosses the Delaware River on a frozen Christmas night and they march to Trenton and they bag this garrison of 1,500 Hessians. And, you know, they go back and then they cross again and they take on Cornwallis, right? And then they evade Cornwallis and they you know, he attacks Princeton. And what he's able to do in the larger cell, he's able to take the war from the doorsteps of Philadelphia to he gains back almost all of New Jersey, right? Through a series of well-executed moves. And it's not that the design, if you look at the designs of the attacks, they're very amateur, right? In a way, and in a way that would ultimately fail in any other given time. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, it's like you're playing a poker game and he just goes all in. You're like, what are you doing? You know what I mean? Like, you're crazy, but it works for him, right? It works this one time when it needs to work, right? So, you know, we get through that and, you know, obviously that, you know, makes him a legend within his own time. So one of the things I think is important about his personal leadership comes at Princeton. There's a lot of great moments, but this is the one that's always been in my head. And essentially what's happening is the Battle of Princeton happens. It's kind of a meeting engagement. It's not necessarily planned the way he had planned it. And Colonel Mahood, right? Like the 17th Regiment of Foot attacks, they break Mercer's veterans. Mercer's veterans run, and Mercer's killed, Hazlitt's killed, all these guys, and they run and they fall back into they fall back into a group called the Philadelphia Associators, which are a militia that had never seen combat. And like they start to break in panic. So Washington at that point had written back, right? Like the commander in chief, right? This is a big rank, right? This is an important general. He rides in front of these breaking troops in between the lines of the British and his faltering troops, and inspires them on. You know, he says something effective, pray with me, my fine fellows, you know, we shall have them today, or something to that effect. I'm butchering the quote, but it inspires them, right? And then he disappears into the smoke, right? And it's like he gets enshrouded in smoke and everyone just assumes he's dead. And he pops out or he emerges from the smoke, and they said it was like a phoenix out of the ashes. And it's like these moments that consistently happen throughout the war, like they're like incredible. They defy human reasoning a lot of times. And he becomes this iconic hero to his own men, and the men become personally loyal to him. So I'll pause there. Let you get your next question in before we get into later on.
Well, I'm very conscious that what we don't want to do is just tell the entire story of the war, I guess, through the medium of this episode. But
yeah,
what do you think it is that enables this success, rather than sort of specific examples and all the rest of it? What is it that sort of underpins the fact that he is able to turn this around?
I think it's this ability. And I've thought about this quite often in my own mind, but it's like, you know, I try to put myself into his shoes or whoever's shoes that I'm studying at that moment. But you know, for his case, for him, and it's like, you have all these defeats, you have all these disasters, right? And we'll use New York as an example, right? All these disasters. And it's just like anybody would probably like mentally and emotionally fall apart, right? Because we define success off of battlefield victories, or, you know, everybody wants to see their enemy run. I mean, that's just, you know, what a military, but the fact that that doesn't happen to him, but he remains confident, right? He has this ability to say, if like I can still turn this around, and like he's able to take these negative attributes of defeat and use them to his advantage. And I think that that is like his defining feature as a general, right? That is his defining feature of, we can lose. Prime example for all my hockey fans out there, especially, you know, America, 1980, right? Team USA, which was a bunch of college kids, right? You know, become the US Olympic hockey team, and they take on and they beat the Russian hockey team, which were professional, right? I think they were undefeated, right? And it's just that one time they're going to beat them probably 99 times out of 100, but the one time we were able to beat them, right? And that's Washington. That's a very American mentality. And I think we get that from Washington, and really the kind of the patriot theme in general. We can lose and lose and lose, get our faces kicked in as often as we, but we're still going to be here. We're still going to smile on your face, and we're still going to hope, you know, we're going to maintain ourselves. And like, that's what eventually becomes, whether that's his mindset at the beginning or something he kind of develops into, I think it's more the latter, but he accepts that and plays that to his advantage. Now, that being said, you know, not everybody accepts that, right? I mean, there's the cabal at Valley Forge. There's the disaster and the embarrassment of losing Philadelphia the following, you know, so there's a lot, but he maintains that confidence in himself and his men. And as a result, that confidence, right, expands out to, you know, the Congress is able to say, okay, well, we trust him. He had that very trustworthy personality in his strategy.
So let's fast forward to sort of life post-war.
Sure. He is the first official president of the United States. However, there are presidents of Congress before that. So, but he's the first to hold the executive branch.
Okay, this shows how little I understood at school. Because who is it who's the first president of Congress? Because I'm sure mentally I've kind of thought is it Adams who, we might have to cut off of this just to, you know, deal with my ignorance here, but did Jefferson and Adams precede in that sense?
In terms of, well, John Hancock is, at least during a portion of the war, and I apologize to all my fellow historians that are more focused on that aspect of it, but John Hancock is certainly the president of Congress, at least during the beginning of the war. I don't know if he remains that throughout the entire war, but I mean, you know, Jefferson ends up becoming governor of Virginia during the war. So his role in, you know, after kind of 76, he kind of, you know, goes back to Virginia, but John Adams stays and things like that. But I mean, there's this, you know, when the war ends in 1783, the United States is not really the United States yet. It's under the Articles of Confederation, which proves within that short time frame that it fails. And one of the things that escalates that is Shays' Rebellion in Massachusetts. And you know, they quickly realize that it's, you know, it's not a good system, so they need to do something. So where Washington comes into play really is, again, he's had this, you know, and you know, to kind of touch back onto the war real quick, I mean, the whole Newburgh thing is incredible because it's the end of the war in 1782, and all of the officers in the Continental Army had decided that, you know, there was always a distrust between Congress and the Army, always, always. And it's almost Congress hated the Army to a degree, right? And the officers felt that they were entitled to a pension. Whether or not they were, that's a different debate, but they certainly felt that. And they had planned, at least in 1782, they were going to like pull a coup or a cabal or, you know, something to that degree. And Washington catches word of this. He doesn't announce it. He doesn't have any swift retribution. What he does is he calls his officers to a meeting, all of the officers, and he enters the room and he gives a very impassioned speech, to the point where there were tears shed, and everybody basically says, yeah, we were wrong, you know. So he has that kind of, he has control over emotions of people, right? And different backgrounds. So the reason I tell you that is because you get into the post-war stuff and then development of what becomes the Constitution and stuff like that. But he's not necessarily a politically astute person. He's no Madison, he's no Jefferson, he's no Adams. He's a military person with a little bit of experience in politics in Virginia. So, but they all recognize him as probably the most necessary element, because by his presence in the room when they write the Constitution and they work on it, he acts as a counterweight. He acts as a stabilizing force for these very extreme personalities and views on, you know, so what becomes the Federalist, Anti-Federalist. The other thing about Washington that's also incredible is he's apolitical. He does not believe in political parties. As a matter of fact, in his farewell address, he very much implies do not form political parties. Well, we failed there. And he says, do not get involved in European affairs. Well, we failed there too. So, I mean, that was certainly his viewpoint on everything. He says, you know, one of the things that Washington, to me, more than anybody else, he's the first to really capitalize or really capture what becomes this American identity, right? And that's this, you know, he's able to take the you know, the ratchety New Englanders and the pacifist Mid-Atlantic and the genteel, you know, superior, you know, society of the South, and he's able to say, look, we are very different people, but we can come together at key moments and we can work together as one. And Washington's kind of the glue for that in a lot of ways. Now, it's not perfect, and obviously we know later American history, there's still challenges today on that, you know, but he's the one that said we can do this. And he also sets precedent. So, you know, again, I said earlier, he's the first to kind of, you know, bring a cabinet into the presidency and into American politics. And it includes some very brilliant minds, you know, Hamilton and Jefferson and Madison, and, you know, and they all hate each other to a degree or something. And that's a whole different, you know, people that read on that know, but, you know, he on his second term wasn't going to run because they stressed him out so much. And they all say, listen, Madison, Jefferson, have they all come to him and say, listen, if you don't run, this is all going to fall apart. We need you. And to the point where Jefferson's like, I will stop my personal attacks on Hamilton if you take a second term. That's how powerful he was in the room, right? You know, but he's also sets the precedent for a two-term presidency. He probably could have kept going, should he have chosen to, but he didn't. And probably the most defining feature of Washington And I think this encapsulates whether it's his military service, his political service, or his ambitions in life. Is, I mean, when you think about it, the man at 1783 was, you know, the most powerful figure in America. In theory, right? He could, you know, if he wants to just become a dictator, he probably could have. Who's going to stop him? But he has this ability to hand power back. He hands power back. And he recognizes that the power isn't necessarily his, it's the people's, to whatever degree, you know, that we want to define that. You know, obviously it's a different standard then than it is now, but he gives it back and he trusts in the cause, in the system, right? So I think one of his greatest legacies is that. And, it, you know, so, if, you know, if we're going to talk about legacy, it's certainly the ability to, in humbleness, to get power back. But it's also the ability to say, no matter how hard things get, no matter how much things are going against us, if we stick to the cause, right, and the cause becomes our number one driving force, we will prevail. And he shows that through 8 years of war and a lot of drama that occurred in between of it.
What, I mean, there are just a handful of things I want to touch on to as we sort of start to wrap this up. But and those are, you know, flaws, myths, and modern memory. So we'll start with, I guess, the myths. What are the myths? Because a character like this, there are bound to be myths that pop up about him. What are the ones that you hear where you just go, no, that's really, you haven't understood your history there, kind of thing?
Well, I mean, a lot of the myths, certainly, you know, oh gosh, there's so many. There's like personal ones with them, and then there's kind of an overarching. I mean, you know, one of the most recognizable immediately is the crossing of the Delaware, right? Like, you know, everybody sees the Emanuel Leutze painting, right? Of Washington crossing the Rhine River, because that's what it is, right? And, you know, of course, they have him standing up in the boat, and there's the American flag, which none of that, you know, the flag didn't exist yet. And I don't know, I've crossed that part of the river many times at that time of year, and I will tell you right now, you are not standing up. The wind will put you down in your seat, right? You know, but, you know, but that's this image. So, you know, you get this nationalized image of Washington, and a lot of that comes through, in my opinion, the historiography, which I like to blame George Bancroft for. And, you know, nothing against George Bancroft, but I mean, he's kind of the first major historian we have. And of course, you know, Washington's your hero, and you have to paint him in that sense. So it becomes mythological. But, you know, some of the other things, you know, but like, whereas the Princeton, right, incident I talked about, that was true. So there are true incidences, but it just becomes like this, you know, like he's just this, what's true and what's not true. I mean, there's the, you know, the whole prayer at Valley Forge. You know, Washington wasn't necessarily a religious man. I mean, well, I don't want to say he wasn't religious, but he's not religious to the standard of, you know, he's a deist, right? So he's got a different concept of, you know, I don't think he's going to hit his knees and pray to a higher power necessarily. So there's these moments, right? And in order to capture that mythology and the desperation of it, I think we've painted him sometimes in ways that aren't necessarily accurate to the degree. In other ways, you know, there's this mentality that expands outside of him that, you know, the American army with his leadership, you know, were superior, you know, oh, we showed those British really well. And the truth is, okay, yeah, we won the war, but we didn't win the war in a decisive measure. We won the war through a Fabian, you know, drawing it out and making it, you know, almost impossible for the British to win it. If you're measuring off of battlefield victories, well, you guys won, right? If you're measuring off of capabilities in the battlefield and tactical genius, and, you know, he's certainly not in the top 10, in my opinion, in that regard. So, you know, you know, in that sense, the mythology is hard because it's a matter of opinion, right? And how you think of them. So if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And it leads me neatly on to the penultimate thing, which is sort of failings. I mean, we've heard a lot about, you know, the things that he did and the benefits that he brought and the way in which his character has been something that Americans since have in a number of ways sought to emulate.
Yeah.
But nobody's perfect. So yeah. What were his failings as a human being, as a, not necessarily on a military level, because we've talked about those, but as just as a human being, what do you look at and go, you know what, that wasn't so great?
That's hard. I mean, in my personal perspective, there's nothing when I think of George Washington that immediately, like, you know, I don't like this about him. You know what I mean? Like, and then, but like, there's, you know, for one, I mean, I think one of the things that he falls short on, you know, is he, and I think it, you know, a lot of it has to deal with inexperience and not having a precedent, but, you know, he tends to jump into things throughout the war and not necessarily have a solution. I don't necessarily think that's his fault. I think it's more of a necessity thing, but see, but where that might be his failing, he's also accountable to taking that and rearranging it to benefit him. And then, so he learns from a lot of his mistakes, right? And, you know, he might make the same mistakes consistently. Like, you know, I talked about, you know, leaving his flank open. Well, he does that at Long Island. He does it at Brandywine. And, you know, and it's like, you know, learn your lesson, you know, to a degree. But after Brandywine, he never does it again, right? So where he makes these, you know, or you know, I mean, a lot of it would be military in nature. But, I mean, sometimes he makes mistakes with listening to people, right, or trusting people too much. And, you know, well, a great mistake would be, I mean, obviously he has his spat with Charles Lee, but I mean, obviously probably, I, you know, forgive me for taking so long to bring this one out, but I mean, the whole Benedict Arnold thing, right? I mean, like he's devastated by that, right? So Washington, I guess, you know, he takes a lot of things personal, right? Because for him, this cause is so personal, and it's become personal. And you know, the fact that, you know, you have other people that may have alternate ambitions to fighting the war that are outside the cause, right, upsets him. Arnold becomes a personal vendetta for Washington that obviously he's never able to come to terms with. But in the same way, personally, is New York, right? New York is a huge, huge personal. I mean, he loses it in 76, and he doesn't walk back into New York City, I believe, until November of 1783. And what we see a lot of is this obsession to redeem the loss of New York. Now, he's, you know, got all this other experience behind him now. He's got all these, you know, moments that have immortalized him in his own time, but he cannot let go of the loss of New York on a personal level. So there's this, I guess there's this question that I'd have to look into it further, I guess, but does this ambition, this drive, this obsession with New York dictate a lot of the strategy, and maybe could the war have ended earlier, you know, if he wasn't so focused? I don't know, right? I mean, it's you know, in that, to that degree, he tends to, you know, something that personally hurts him, he tends to lock onto, and, you know, and I guess you're playing with fire then, you know, to that degree. You know, but as far as like personality, I mean, he doesn't really, you know, he doesn't really have any, even the officers that backstab him, like Thomas Conway, who's I guess Irish heritage, but he's French born, so he's French, right? Officer, you know, he tries to dethrone Washington about before. I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, he never loses his cool. He doesn't snap. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't talk about hanging people, or, you know, he just, he has a certain way about him. But, I don't know. I mean, to that degree, I mean, I don't know. I mean, is that a failure, right? Should you have been more harsh with someone like Conway? I don't know, right? I mean, but it's maybe he's too relaxed. Maybe he's too refined. Maybe, you know, but I also like to point out, you know, could you have taken any other founding father and put them in his shoes? Like, could you picture Jefferson as commander in chief, or Adams, or, you know, all five foot of Madison, whatever else. I mean, so I think his personality is certainly one of those. I don't want to say he's flawless, because he's not, right? But I think overall his personality was almost meant for the job. It's like, you know, like every once in a while a figure is put into history and they're like perfect for that role, you know? But that's how I would, you know, answer that. If that even answered it, but I don't think it did.
No, you did absolutely. All right, stop doubting yourself, man. The one last one to wrap this up, and I think we probably got flavors of this over the course of the last sort of hour and a half, because, you know, you're an American talking about America's founding father, but how is he remembered today?
Well, I think, again, I think that it's a loaded question, and I will do my best to try to answer it from my individual perspective. And I don't want to speak for all of my fellow countrymen, right? But certainly George Washington is the father of our country. You know, whether that be through his military contribution, his presidency, you know, whatever, you know, that's certainly a thing. I mean, his vision, his face is everywhere, right? His name is everywhere. I don't think there's an American that can say they don't know who George Washington is. They might not know all the detail. They might just know that, you know, but, you know, he's recognizable. You know, I would imagine he's probably very close to, you know, I guess Wellington in that terms, like everybody at least knows who he is, right? You know, if you're, I mean, certainly in the military culture, he's the first general. I mean, so in the military, I mean, to, you know, I guess to different parts of society, it just depends on what your beef is, you know. So certainly the Native Americans, I would assume, probably don't look at him in the same light as other Americans do. But it's hard to, you know, I mean, I've never actually had a conversation with Native American on that topic. So I really don't want to speak for, I don't really know exactly how they view him, but I would imagine it's not, you know, into the same degree as the father of a country. It's probably, you know, the father of a country who ruined ours. Right. So to that degree, I don't know, but I think overall, he's a respected individual. And I think a big part of that comes from what we've just been talking about, a lot of his personality traits. I mean, I think if he was a pretentious or someone who was an aggressively minded kind of, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think he would be, he wasn't like a Joseph Stalin, right? Or something like that. I mean, I know nothing against, but you know, he doesn't have that. So he's hard. He's very much lionized. He's hard. It's hard to rip him down on any given part. I mean, unless you're someone who just, you know, it was affected by what happens in the United States after the war. But it's, I think by and large, he's just someone who's accepted. You know, if that's how I would answer it. I'm sure other people would have different opinions, but I mean,
I mean, that's the fun of history, right? We all have different opinions on the topic.
Eddie, I mean, he's not as divisive as Napoleon, right? Like, I mean, I've never seen, like, I've seen, you know, especially in Napoleonic, I mean, people are like, you know, but I've never really seen, it's almost, when you get to George Washington, there's people that love him, really love him, super love him, fanatically love him, right? Like, it's like, to what level? I mean, very rarely do I see anybody that, I'll be honest with you, I've never seen anybody, like, really rip him to shreds. I like to keep myself more towards a realist perspective. Like, I recognize him as who he is and his contributions, but I also like to look at him through the human element, not so much the mythological element. So I'd probably be more towards that centered proportion of him. Whereas other people, I don't think would be able to, like, you know, they put him in a status of a god. So, you know, it just depends.
It absolutely does. Eddie, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Folks, you know the drill by now. If you're new here, remember to hit that subscribe button so that you can find your way back. And if you're loving the show, remember to leave a review. It makes a vast amount of difference in terms of helping this show to reach a wider audience. Much love to all of my Patreon supporters who hopefully are going to start enjoying some slightly different elements of the perk package. Shout outs to my mentioned in dispatches patrons, Rob Griffith, Brendan Teeling, Beatrice DeGraff, Lynn Dawson, Lucy Tatner, Jim Deary, Josh Keeney, Colin Fieldhouse, Stephen Coulson, Jim Getz, Stephen Gillen, Hugh Brennan, Alistair Campbell-Grieve, Andy Meakin, Mark Anscombe, Rob Coughlin, Bruins Girl, Noah Fink, Mark Trowbridge, Mars Reedy, Nick Overland, Graham Goodwin, Chris Pramus, Anthony Gumbau, Anonymous American, Martin Pisani, Auric Decado, James Fluick, Roger O'Donnell, Natasha Hobday, Rod Schwager, Chris Kimball, Gary Dennis, David Graylick, Ted Andrews, David Milinski, Richard Anderson, Arthur Forgy, Sam Moore, Wyatt Pollock, Carol Dixon-Smith, Roland Shark, Jason Moran, and Mark Chestnut. And the admirals, John Haynes, Ryan Diamond, J.C. Kaiser, Bob Burnham, Mike Guest, Liam Telfer, Todd and Led Campbell, Graham Swidenbank, Rachel Stark, Mark Duckers, David Maxwell, David Priest, Graham Callister, Sean Sullivan, Stephen Ashworth, Dan Hazelwood, Kate Walcombe, Steve Carter, Clemens Bemmon, Charles McKay, Reto the Sci-Fi Fan, and Tim Day. I'll be back very soon, but until then, I'm Zach White. This has been the Napoleonic Wars Pod. Take care of yourselves, my friends. Stay well, stay safe. And as always, thank you for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.